Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Peter Armstrong.
And I'm Talia Schlanger. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
Cold Comfort, a Russian publisher, remembers the warm, hopeful, and defiant letters Alexei Navalny sent from inside the Arctic penal colony where he was imprisoned before his death last week.
Hitting the mark, the government of Finland launches a plan to open hundreds of firing ranges. We ask a member of parliament why he pulled the trigger on the scheme and if he's worried about it backfiring.
Finding her voice. Hannah Ha always knew her mother could sing, but it wasn't until she stumbled on an old record that she learned her mom was a legend who belted out some of the first rock and roll sung in Vietnamese.
Eyeing a bat without batting an eye. You may remember the viral video, an Irish family contends with a kitchen-invading bat. You'll hear from the man who shot that video and from his unflappable, towel-wielding father, the legendary Derry.
Feeling down. One moment, a Nova Scotia man was out for a snowy walk with his dog. The next, he was through an open manhole, standing in icy, neck-high water, wondering if anyone would hear him calling for help.
And the seal deal. A PEI constable describes getting a call about a seal walking up the highway and tells us how he wrestled it off the road and into the back of his cruiser. As It Happens, the Monday edition, radio that wonders what'll be his next adventure.
Три дня назад Владимир Путин убил моего мужа Алексея Навального. Путин отнял самое дорогое, что у меня было, самого близкого и самого любимого человека.
Yulia Navalnaya has stepped into the spotlight days after the death of her husband, Alexei Navalny. In a video, she blamed Vladimir Putin for killing the Russian opposition leader. Russia claims Mr. Navalny lost consciousness after a walk at the Arctic penal colony where he was imprisoned. Authorities have so far refused to hand over his body and reportedly told his mother that he died from, quote, sudden death syndrome, unquote. Mr. Navalny was serving a 30-year sentence after he returned to Russia in 2021. During his imprisonment, he exchanged regular letters with another Russian dissident, Ilya Krasilshik. We reached Mr. Krasilshik in Berlin, Germany.
Ilya, after exchanging all these very personal letters, what was it like to learn the news of Alexei Navalny's death?
Heartbreaking. I don't know. Never happened something like this in my life. I'm not sure I can describe this feeling yet. On so many levels, it's so tragic and so heartbreaking and so awful and so frightened. I still don't believe that this has happened.
Mr. Navalny's family clearly believes that he was murdered. If that does turn out to be true, what do you make of the timing here? Why would they target him now?
Maybe because they tried to silence him in many different ways, by jailing him, by poisoning him, by sending him for some gulag prison in the far north. But he wasn't silenced, and he wrote, and he talked, and he contacted with his organization. So he didn't stop fighting.
You received so many letters and exchanged so many letters with him. Can you tell me a bit about the last one that you received from Mr. Navalny, I believe, in October? What kinds of things were on his mind then?
It's really interesting for him to discuss not only the future of Russia, yes, or some past or anything like this, but he was really eager to discuss the gossips, what happened in different cities. He asked me to compare Tbilisi, where I lived before, to Berlin. He wanted to know everything about food, about France, about what's happening. So he was really lively, and he wanted to know everything. So, and from my perspective, from what I read from in his letters, he wasn't depressed. Yes, he was really optimistic. It was hard for him there, surely, but he never said anything about any problems. He understood that this can happen to him, but from his letters, it's clear that he loved life, yes, and he loved life in many ways.
It's so remarkable, though, in detention, in really tough conditions, that's what he was writing about, that sort of almost a lightness to the things that he was writing about. Where do you think he found that in the midst of such a horrific place?
I think this is a really important genre right now for Russians who are opposed to the regime, to write to some political prisoners in Russia, yes? And unfortunately, there are a lot. In many cases, it really helps for them when you write not about some how are you doing or we're here for you, but you write about your day-by-day life, yes? Because it's helped them to feel themselves not so isolated. And this is not only about Alexei, this is about a lot of other prisoners, yes? This news from freedom, yes? The news about what did you eat or what did you, whom did you saw yesterday?
Right.
It's really like a part of the normal life, yeah? It was really... So when you read this and when you write about this, you are still alive. And this is a really important feeling.
Ilya, you yourself, you were sentenced to 8 years in prison in absentia. You live in exile in Germany now. Why do you think Mr. Navalny made that choice to go back to Russia, to face imprisonment and something that a lot of people said might happen, his eventual death?
I asked him, and he answered. And he answered that this is his way, and he had no second thought about it, and his family had no second thought about it. And this is his way. This is his way as a politician, and he need to do this. And that's it. Surely, from my point of view, I prefer him alive and free. But this was his choice, and this actually the choice which made him, like as somebody said, a superhero. I don't know. Yes, superhero is dead right now, so I don't know. But he was absolutely sure that this is his way and he need to walk this way. Yeah, so he was 100% sure.
We're seeing people take to the streets. We're seeing people leave flowers at various tributes and monuments. Do you think the impact he wanted to have... It hasn't happened yet, but do you think it might be happening?
I hope that his words and his thoughts and his hope, yes, and he was hopeful till the end, right. I think. The last thing I got from him was about hope, and that he had no problem with hope. He had a lot. So I hope that his hope will be reality in... I don't know when, but it will happen. And his wife and the brilliant Yulia Navalny today said that she will continue what Alexei did. And I think she is our hope right now.
Where do you think this leaves the opposition movement that Mr. Navalny led?
Don't know. We had a leader and we don't have a leader anymore. And but when, you know, when I... saw Yulia in Munich, and I saw the leader, and I hope that she can be it. I don't know does she want it, but I see no other leaders right now, and I think she has a mandate for this. We had Alexei for 15 years, and for 15 years he was the most important guy in the opposition movement, and he was, and his brilliance, it's really hard to, I don't know, to recreate this. We have nobody who can replace him. Yeah.
Look, this is a difficult time, and I'm just really grateful you're able to make time to speak with us today. Thank you for this.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
We reached Ilya Krasilchik in Berlin, Germany. When you think of classic Finnish hobbies, you think ice hockey, football, cross-country skiing. Shooting might not immediately come to mind, but the government of Finland is hoping to add it to the list. The country is the most recent to join NATO, and as part of an effort to raise public interest in national defense, it's planning to open 300 new shooting ranges. Jukka Kopra is an MP for the Finnish Coalition Party. We reached him in a busy cafe in Brussels.
Jukka, do you like to spend time at the shooting range yourself?
Yes, I've been practicing shooting all my life, but not very much these days. So because of my parliamentary work, I don't have so much time to go shooting myself.
Fair enough.
So much.
So walk me through this. So how will adding more shooting ranges, specifically for civilian hobbyists, how will that help the country's defense model?
Well, yes, we have about 700 shooting ranges in Finland at the moment, and we've seen the tremendous need that we should have more because people are willing to practice shooting and have reserve training as a hobby these years. And this, of course, this new situation has arisen from the Russia's unprovoked attack to Ukraine. And we have a conscription system in Finland. We have reservist army. We have a nation of about 5 million people, but we have 900,000 trained reservists, which are the backbone of our defense. And then we have about 300,000 hunters in Finland who also practice shooting. And at the moment, we've just seen that the having a shooting as a hobby has become too complicated because the ranges are so rare and they're far away. So the government wanted to up this figure so that people would have more possibilities to practice shooting.
You say that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a part of this, and Finland shares a 1,300-kilometer border with Russia. What are people thinking? What are they worried about? Is there a common thought that maybe Russia will invade Finland next?
No. I'd say that there's no sense of fear or nothing like that, or no sense of immediate threat. But people have realized that, okay, this defending our country, of course, it's our duty and of course, our privilege. So people want to take part and people want to sort of pitch in their effort in the defense of our country. And after this attack in Ukraine, we have seen a tremendous rise in voluntary military training, voluntary shooting training, and so forth. So people are interested in this and they want to be part of our defense.
Is there some concern that more people knowing how to shoot might lead to more gun violence?
Well, we have very strict gun control and gun laws, and we are not seeking to release these any easier. So we intend to keep this strict control of who is able to purchase guns and have guns at home. But to those people who are eligible to having guns, we want to give more possibilities to practice shooting.
You know, and part and parcel to all of this, more involvement with the reservists, more voluntary training, more time at the shooting ranges, you're seeing more Finns applying for gun licenses. Why do you think specifically on the gun licenses? What are people telling you that that's all about?
Well, I have to say that I have no recent information about what's the level of the applications for gun licenses at the moment. So has there been a tremendous increase or not? I don't know that, but our reserve training system and voluntary training system, the organization has guns and people can sort of go to organized shooting events and under supervision practice shooting with those guns that are owned by the voluntary training organization. But of course, to do this, they need more shooting ranges, and that's the question today.
You know, there used to be, I think it's like 2,000 ranges in Finland, and there was much more widespread involvement in this voluntary training. And I think a lot of people are looking at this story of boosting the number of ranges as a new thing. I wonder how you see it. Is this a return to how things used to be, and maybe these last 40 years have been the anomaly? Or are we entering into a new phase and a new stage for your country?
Well, I'd say that maybe you could see this as a return to normal Finnish habit of that you can go and practice shooting in controlled circumstances and situations in shooting range. We definitely used to have more shooting ranges, but most of them were ad hoc shooting ranges, like on sand pits and so forth, and with no protection, no fences, so forth. And we have a regulation what a shooting range has to be like, and it has to be secure. And of course, the environmental issues have to be taken into consideration. And I think that at present, the biggest obstacle of setting up a new shooting range is exactly these environmental regulations. And we seek to release those a little or develop new ways to apply for permits for easier to set up.
I wonder, just in closing, what message do you think Finns are sending, not just to the world in general, but to Russia in particular, as they go through this process of more voluntary training and getting more gun experience and shooting ranges available? What message do you think they're sending to Russia?
I think the general message is that the Finns are very united as it comes to defending our country. So we generally do not have political debate about our defense issues, but they are sort of ruled out and decided almost unanimously in the parliament. And I think that's a value we should sort of appreciate and take care of, because united people, and people are united like this, it's a very good message, especially for our violent neighbor, Russia.
All right, we're going to leave it there, but I really appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Bye.
Have a good day.
Jukka Kopra is an MP for the Finnish Coalition Party. We reached him in Brussels. Dan Webb has a survival story to tell, but it begins with the Halifax man just heading out to walk his dog. Mr. Webb is 71, and after snow hit the city earlier this month, he took the dog out on their usual route by the Canada Games Centre in the Clayton Park neighborhood of the city. But as Dan Webb explains, that day's route had an unannounced detour.
The dog wanted to go and pee on a light standard. I let his lead go because, he's just going over to pee. He ran through the snow. I took one step down, then I think one step onto the snowbank, and the next step into pristine snow, which turned out to be nothing there. The next thing I realized was I was underwater, struggling to get up and get the water out of my mouth and my nose that was in there. Once I did that, I realized I was in deep trouble. I had worked in manholes when I was younger in Calgary, and there was no way out. I knew there was no way out for me on my own to get out.
But your thought was, there's no way that you're going to die down here. Take us through what's going through your head.
At first, it was like, I'm really in deep trouble here, and I'm on my own. My only thoughts really were, like you say, I'm not going to die here alone. So
some of your background came in handy here. As you mentioned, you'd had some experience, maybe not falling down manholes, but
working in manholes.
Uh-huh.
And because of my knowledge of cabling and such, that's the reason that I started looking at the end walls to see if there was conduits there.
Were you able to stand?
I was standing up to my neck. in water while I was doing this, yes.
And then what did you do?
When I found the cable, I tried to stand up on it, and the first time I fell down because it was slippery with silt. And then my mind clicked in, okay, this isn't going to work. You've got to – so I put my hands up. It's hard to explain. And I just put my fingernails in between a crack between the rings in the neck coming down, the round part. And I held on to that, got up on that up onto the cable, took my two fists, put them against the opposite side in the neck of the manhole. And then I started screaming at the top of my lungs.
What were you screaming?
Help, help me, please. I'm in the manhole. Help, help me, please. I'm in the manhole. And then I got tired. So I realized, you know, I've got to do something to save my energy because I was getting very cold and starting to shake and such. So anyways, just when I thought things were not going to go well, this lovely lady poked her head down the hole and said, "You're going to be okay, sir.
Oh,
I'm phoning 911. You're going to be okay."
That was the 71-year-old Halifax man, Dan Webb. And the face at the top of the manhole belonged to a woman named Colleen Pascal. Colleen says she had dismissed Dan's cries, but then something told her to take another look. They spoke on Friday to Portia Clark of CBC Nova Scotia's Information Morning. For Matthew Muirhead, being a police officer in rural Atlantic communities has meant his fair share of animal-related calls. Horses, a bear, moose, but never a seal. That changed earlier this month when one ended up in the back of his car. We reached RCMP Constable Muirhead in Johnstons River, Prince Edward Island.
Matthew, any more seal wrangling recently?
We haven't had any in the last couple of days, nope.
So take us back. What can you tell us about the call you received that set you off on this adventure?
Well, we received the call probably around 6 or 6:30 that night from Mars. Mars is located out in Nova Scotia. It's the Marine Animal, I guess, Rescue Services.
Right.
That there was a seal walking up the highway in Murray Harbor.
Now, forgive me, I'm from Toronto, so I think an animal on the road, why do the police need to get involved in that? Why not kind of just let nature do its thing, let it wander around? Why do police need to step in a case like that?
Police don't always need to step in cases like that. Sometimes on shift, there's going to be other different services that could handle it. But we had just had a recent storm here in PEI, and the snow drifts were quite high. Ice was frozen. And I guess the animal must have gotten turned around and just didn't know how to get back to where it needed to be. And it was on a highway, so there's obviously traffic. And it's, you know, out here in the Atlantic Canada, there's not lights on every highway.
Right.
So it could have been a bad thing for the seal.
And just to be clear, it wasn't exactly along the coast where you found the seal, right?
No, it was about 3 kilometers from what I could see on my map from the ocean.
Like, man, so that's a long way.
It's a ways, yeah, for a baby seal.
And how big of a seal are we talking about here?
Probably around 50 to 75 pounds. He was probably 3, 3.5, 4 feet long. We say baby seal. It probably wasn't a baby. It was probably a pup. So a little bit older. It's not just something that I could just pick up on my own and just put in the bag and put in the back of my car.
Right. This is the size of a good-sized dog, but it's like pure muscle.
Correct. Yeah, probably a good German Shepherd size. Right. Solid.
So you get there, were the residents around sort of pointing you to where the seal was?
Yeah, so when we came down the road, we were able to see a car with its four ways on, and they were just basically following the seal up the road and making sure traffic was diverted for it before someone could get there to help it out. Never had a seal before, never had to deal with a seal before, dealt with all kinds of other animals, and usually I just try and, you know, shoo them into the woods and get them moving along their way. But he wasn't having anything to do with that. And, you know, he needed to be in water. So we had to figure out a different way to get this pup in our car and down to some place where we could get it safe.
What did you try first? Were you looking for like a blanket in your car or something? How do you approach that situation?
Yeah, we have blankets in the back of our cars, but they're rather thin. They're the emergency blankets. So like they're good for heat, but they're not
slippery.
Really good for, yeah, they're slippery and seals might be biting through that.
Right.
So there was a lady nearby who was helping out with the traffic, and she just walked to her house and managed to get us a cord that we could try and make a leash out of, sort of to get it wrapped up and, you know, pulled in towards our car. That didn't work. He was having nothing of that. So she brought us a blanket, a pretty thick blanket, and we basically got it up and around and wrapped the seal up into like a burrito and put him in the car.
A seal burrito.
Seal burrito, yeah.
Now, from the moment you arrived to the moment the seal burrito technique finally worked, how long are we talking?
I'd say any from 20-25 minutes. Yeah, he wasn't going easy.
like, what is the disposition of the seal through this?
He wasn't happy with us. He was hissing at us and snapping at us. You know, so we backed off a little bit. We didn't want to cause any harm to the animal either. You know, by getting it overexcited. So we just tried to do this as, I don't even know the word, as calmly as possible right. For everybody involved, I guess.
And have I got this right? You got bit during this process.
I did. When I tried to wrap the blanket under his neck, he got a snap at my finger. But I was wearing puncture-proof gloves that we do wear. So just a quick pain. No, it didn't puncture my skin or anything so like that. So, yeah.
Now, you load the seal eventually into your patrol car. You've probably had people that you've said acted like wild animals, but what is it like actually driving with a wild animal, a seal, in the back of your patrol car?
It actually wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I figured he'd be squirming and smashing and just making all kinds of noise. He just lied back on that seat and was quiet, and he enjoyed the drive. That was quite the shocker.
Put on some music for the seal?
Yeah, no, there was nothing on it.
Okay, so you get it to the destination, I suppose, and everything ends well there?
Well, we got him down to what's called the Murray Wharf Lane is what I call it. There's a harbor there. There's like a fishing plant down there. But I guess the ice was too thick for him to just get into water. So we dropped him there hoping he'd crawl out towards the broken water, and we headed back to our detachment, and we got another call that same buddy was headed up the wharf lane and headed towards the highway again.
Stubborn little thing.
He knew where he wanted to go, I guess.
So you find him again. This time you've got your technique note down. Was it easier the second time to wrap him up and get him back in?
Much easier the second time. I actually arrived first. There's three of us headed out to that one. I arrived first, got the blanket out, wrapped him up, and just waited for the other boys to get there. And once they got there, we picked them up, put them in my car again, and we took them down to Murray River, where I knew the ice was broken. And there's a place called Seal Cove, so maybe he could go visit some family. Who knows, right? But we got him down there, and yeah, he got into that water and took off, so it was great.
And part of the problem has been that there's less ice, right? There's less ice than there used to be in the harbor, and so the seals are coming ashore more? Is that what's going on here?
That's what I've read. That's what I've read recently in the last couple of days and the last couple of weeks about the ice issue. I'm no expert in that, so I can't say, but that's what everyone's saying.
And how quickly does this, like, you must have been the talk of the town right out of the gates. Did everybody know about this?
Well, you know, Facebook. My kids knew about it. Hey, Dad, you're on Facebook. I'm like, how am I on Facebook?
What do they make of your newfound fame as a seal wrangler?
Oh, the kids love it. The kids are used to it. The family's used to it. You know, small town policing, you know, everyone knows everybody. Everyone knows everybody's father. And it's, you know, your name's out there. You even say, hey, I saw your dad on the traffic stop, or I saw your dad here. And that's just the way it is. They're used to it.
Thank you for your work and in getting the seal to the water and for sharing it all with us today. It's been great to hear from you.
Thank you.
That was RCMP Constable Matthew Muirhead in Johnston's River PEI.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
In many parts of the country, today is a holiday.
And in some provinces, it's Family Day. But even if you're celebrating Louis Riel Day or Heritage Day or Islander Day, there's a good chance you've been spending at least some of it with your family anyway, possibly agreeing or disagreeing with them about what to do with the holiday. Here at As It Happens, we could all agree on one thing: to kick off our special programming with the Fleming family. Who could forget Derry and Maureen Fleming, their son, Tig, and their puppy, Basil? As Tig put it, the Flemings are, quote, your typical Irish family. Or at least they were, until an intruder broke into their home.
Catch him! Catch him, Derry! Derry, catch him! There's a bat! Get a bat! Get a bat! Get a bat! Get a bat out of the house! Big or tall, that's it. Get him now, quick. Get him. Oh, Maureen, will you stop looking in the door?
That's a clip from the viral video Tig Fleming recorded when a bat flew into his family's home in Ballymacalligat, Ireland. That video led to worldwide fame for the Flemings and a phone call from As It Happens. In 2017, the Flemings spoke with our former host, Carol Off, about their battle to capture the tiny critter.
Tig, I want to start with you. Has anyone in your town of Ballymacalligat ever received this much attention?
No one. I'd say I put Ballymacalligat on the map. I'd say it'll be visited by everyone now to visit Bat Dad. But it's crazy how mad it's gotten.
And you mentioned Bat Dad. That's what you're calling your dad. Derry, your son's calling you Bat Dad. So what are people calling you? Are you picking up that name, Bat Dad?
Yes, I sure am. When people are coming into the office where I work, they're saying, oh, do you know the guy, Batman? Is he around?
And this is all because of this crazy video, Tig, that
this
you made and posted. And so, Tig, describe how the bat got into your house.
Oh, my God. It was absolutely nuts. So my mom was doing the ironing in the kitchen, and she went out the back door. She left the back door open, and the bat came straight in. And then she ran out to the hall and started looking through the window, and she left the bat in there with myself and my dad. My immediate reaction was to take the phone out and start videoing it and putting up on Snapchat. And then I hid behind another door in the utility, and I just let my dad one-on-one with the bat. And it just was pure chaos. We're only after getting a pup, and we have him a week. And in the midst of the whole, my dad trying to catch the bat, the pup did his business on the floor. My dad was in my football shorts and woolly socks up to his knees, and it was just absolutely crazy. You couldn't write it. Like, it was pure comedy.
Now, Derry, do you think your son could have helped you? Did you need his help at any point?
Let me tell you, my son was as scared as the mom.
Oh.
He was petrified, and that's why he ran behind the door.
Uh-huh. So he wasn't going to be much help to you anyway.
No, he wasn't, like. Because it was right up his alley then to see his dad inside. Like, he was petrified, really, like, you know.
So he's teasing you.
He left all the work to his dad. Of course, like, I have to protect the family, like. We thought he might be a vampire back.
And you are the man of the house, and you were protecting him.
Yeah, I'm the man of the house. Yeah. I had to protect my family at all costs, even risking my own life.
No, but Derry, your son's teasing you that you picked up a tea towel to start that. And
yeah, well, I thought in the beginning it would be easier, like, with a small, because my first priority, like, would not to harm the little creature. They can fly, I think, is at 40 miles per hour, so I soon learned that. So that's why the towel got a bit bigger, so then I went for the back towel.
And that's how you finally caught it?
Yeah.
Now, okay, so you've both mentioned, besides you and your son and the bat, there was another character here, which was your mom and
mom.
Your wife and mom. And,
yeah, my wife.
So, and what we can hear in the video, what is it you're saying to your mom, Tig?
I was like, tell her, stop looking through the window, Maureen.
And he thought that she was frightening the bat by looking through the window of the door.
And she was putting my dad off as well.
Now, Tig, can I point out to you that you were in behind another window doing exactly the same thing as what your mother was doing?
I know, yeah. I've seen a load of comments saying, why was he giving out to the mom when he was worse than her?
Exactly. So what's your answer to that?
Well, my answer was that I admit that I was afraid of the bat, all right, but I was trying to man up myself, but no, it wasn't working. I was behind the door, and my mom was behind the door, and my dad was the only fella who took on the bet and safely removed him.
All right, so you mentioned there. Okay, one more character we'll introduce into this movie, which is your little puppy.
Basil.
So what, Derry, what was the puppy doing through all of this?
Well, the puppy was running around. Well, I actually had forgotten about the puppy at this stage, like with the pandemonium. So I think his boss, he got a bit of a panic with all that was going on. So he decided to take a leak in the floor. I didn't realize this like until afterwards, until I had the socks on. You know, I felt a bit wet on the socks.
So in the middle of all this, that Basil is peeing on the floor.
Yes.
And Tig catches him. Tig, what, you gave blow by blow commentary of all of this.
I had a bird's eye view of what was going on. I could see my mom. I could see my dad. I could see the dog. It was a great vantage point of everything that was going on. And thank God I filmed it, because we'll have it now forever. And the amount of people saying that they got a good laugh out of it, and just kind of, it's like your typical Irish family, but I just kind of captured the moment on video.
Just a typical Irish family and a bat.
From 2017, Carol Off speaking to Tig and Derry Fleming about the time they struggled to get a bat out of their kitchen. There's an iconic scene in The Empire Strikes Back when Darth Vader freezes Han Solo in carbonite. Bounty hunter Boba Fett then delivers Han's frozen body to Jabba the Hutt. It's an unsavory piece of business, and you would think an unlikely source of inspiration for mother-daughter duo Catherine and Hanalei Pervan to create a savory piece of edible art to feature in their business. But in 2022, Neil spoke with Catherine about the life-sized sculpture of Han Solo trapped in carbonite they created entirely out of bread and displayed outside their family-run bakery.
So, Catherine, for those of our listeners who've not seen this yet, can you describe what's outside your bakery right now?
Well, it's a life-size bread rendition of Han Solo trapped in carbonite.
How big are we talking?
He's 6 feet tall. I had my daughter lay down on the plywood and traced out, because she's 6 feet tall, and apparently they're the same height. We are really big on puns. So he is Pan Solo. Oh, good. So he's Pan Solo, and the evil Jabba the Hutt has trapped him in Levenite.
You are part of the As It Happens family for sure. Just by
oh, good.
All of this works
I
for
found
us.
My people.
You absolutely have. You mentioned you used your daughter as a model to trace her outline. But in terms of making this bread, how did you do that? Take me through that.
So we use something called dead dough. So it doesn't have any leavening, commercial leavening, and there's no yeast or anything in it, because it's tricky enough to work with it and bake it as it is. So it's got a very high sugar content. So essentially it's flour, water, and sugar. And we mold it into like the general shape that we want for the substructure, bake it for 4 or 5 hours till it's literally rock hard, and then start layering and layering and layering upon that.
What was the hardest part, though? Like, there's so many intricate details, so many features to capture what really is a terrifying, terrifying moment. So
it is like
part?
the expression on his face, I think, and the whole image really is so iconic that we didn't want to get the face wrong. That was the trickiest part, because I mean, I could have just done my husband's face and it would have been, you know, he's a handsome guy and all, but everyone would look at it and go, oh man, that's not Harrison Ford.
Wait, are you saying Harrison Ford is more handsome than your husband?
Oh, he's got pretty luscious lips, I will say that.
What is it like to experience all of this and construct this with your daughter?
You know, she's my boss at work. Like, she's the head chef. And when we're working, we've got 50 plus employees. When we're working, she is the head chef and all that entails. And when we're home, because we live together, we have a house together, I'm the boss because I'm the mom. And, you know, But this creative bit of time we have together gives us the opportunity to just hang out and, you know, put some music on and be creative and silly. And it really, I told her the other day, this is my favorite time of the day is when we can just do this together.
From 2022, Neil speaking to Catherine Pervan about the life-size sculpture of Han Solo frozen in carbonite she made with her daughter entirely out of bread, which they appropriately named Pan Solo. Whether it's struggling to capture a bat in your kitchen or baking life-sized bread sculptures of fictional Star Wars characters, taking on a challenge is a great way to bond with family. Joe and Sam Baker took a somewhat more straightforward and straight upward approach when they challenged themselves to take on one of the world's most forbidding rock faces, Yosemite National Park's El Capitan. In 2022, Neil spoke with the father-son duo as they made their way up the rock face in an attempt to make 8-year-old Sam the youngest person ever to reach the peak.
Joe, let me start with you. What's the view like for you right now?
Oh, it's spectacular. The sun is just hitting the mountains right now. It's been a beautiful, chill morning.
The sunrise, I'm sure, is stunning, as you say, but does having Sam with you make it even more special?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had him. He was real cuddly last night, and we were on this little ledge that we slept on, this little rock ledge, and there wasn't a lot of room, so it was kind of just really friendly.
Cozy.
Yep. He's got to brush his teeth, though.
Oh, and we watched The Lion King.
We watched The Lion King last night on my phone.
On the side of the mountain. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. We'd never seen the new one.
What did you think of it?
Oh, it was terrific. What do you think of it, Sam?
Awesome.
He loved it.
Okay. I think you guys are you having some snacks? Did I interrupt breakfast?
Yep. Yeah. We're just kind of like...
What's on the menu?
Right now we're eating Sour Patch Kids.
Watermelon.
We eat a lot of candy.
So, Sam, let me ask you, how was the first day of climbing?
Pretty easy.
I heard you know, you're not just eating Sour Patch Kids up there. I heard you love lasagna, and you've even got lasagna up there. Is that right, Sam?
Uh-huh.
But tell her what we had last night for dinner.
We had mac and cheese.
You guys are killing me with the favorites up there.
Yeah, it's about eating good food in great places.
I like that. Besides those things, Joe, I wonder, as you're making this decision, discussing it with your partner, you know, Sam's mom, factoring in his age, I'm sure. What made you want to do this now, you know, and not when he's a little bit older?
Yeah. Well, first of all, he's ready. Mm-hmm. And we were wanting to do it when he's ready. And we were training him. And he's definitely ready. Yesterday was a piece of cake. And so that was important. But there is actually a record out there that we watched a girl named Sayla who climbed El Capitan when she was 10 with her dad. And when I saw that was about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. I couldn't even sleep. I was so blown away by how much adventure and friendship they shared.
Yeah.
And I just said, wow, I'd like to do that with one of my boys when they're ready. And Sam's ready.
You're still in the middle of this. So what's the strategy? What's the plan for the next few days as you go for the summit?
Well, the next 2 days are much harder mm-hmm. than today. The walk gets a lot steeper. And so we have several more days of climbing, and much more vertical climbing. So, we're kind of done the easy stuff and it just kind of gets bigger and harder from here. But Sam's got it. I think we're going to blast through this and finish The Lion King tonight.
Okay. Well, good luck. Enjoy the film, but also good luck as you try to reach the summit. Sam, Joe, thank you both.
All right, catch you later.
Bye.
From 2022, Neil speaking with Joe and Sam Baker as they climbed El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. You You've just been listening to the As It Happens podcast. You can hear our show Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
You can also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Peter Armstrong. Thanks so much for listening.
And I'm Talia Schlanger.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.